up, brother? What's up?
This is a good recording, man.
Yeah, brother, like, stop right on.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Hey, good morning, Sam. How you doing?
I'm great, Earl. We had an exciting weekend around here at the Shaw, but today's a little gloomy, so I definitely am feeling the nap vibes.
Yeah, it is gloomy to say... the worst. Right now, it's not fit for man nor beast. And it's kind of chilly.
Right? I turned the heat on.
I just turned the heat on in here. And it is June 5th. But, it's going to get better. Let's just give it some time. It is June. The summer is right around the corner, so you know it's not January or February, and in a short period of time, things are going to warm up. But got a lot to talk about today as we await. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams as he's caught in the traffic. It's really heavy because of all the rain, and he'll be here. But until then, Sam, you know, you asked me about an article in today's Milwaukee Journal about the fact that the black student enrollment at UW-Madison has never, I'll repeat that, never exceeded 3%.
Yep, I was very surprised to hear that, but you had a very logical explanation for that I feel like a lot of people don't really think about.
Well, they don't think about the fact that the state of Wisconsin is one of the two most segregated states in the entire nation. Utah is one, but you know what Utah is, right?
Right, like that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
That makes sense, but Milwaukee, Wisconsin, no.
No, but Wisconsin is the second most segregated state in the entire nation.
Wow.
And so blacks only make up 5% of the entire state population. And so when people who live in this state don't realize that small percentage of people of color live in this state. And so all the rest of the state outside of Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, Madison, that's about the extent of the black population in the entire state of Wisconsin, which is a tremendous size when you talk about the sheer mass of the state of Wisconsin.
You think about like the main cities, like where they are, but then when you look at the reality of how rural and massive it all Wisconsin is, that is shocking.
Well, and so that's part of, I think, the big problem is that people don't realize.
No, I had no idea.
So they hear about Milwaukee and they talk about Milwaukee, and that's where the majority of black people are. And so, you know, as a person who lives in Milwaukee, we have to deal with all of the horrible things that happen in our city. Let's go back to Wisconsin, UW-Madison. So back in 1969, UW-Madison had 2.2% black population, 2.2% in 1969. But guess what? In 2021, the black population at UW-Madison, 2.2%.
That's insane to me.
So it has not changed since 1969.
Well, do you remember the scandal kind of that they faced with photoshopping that black student?
Absolutely, I remember it. I mean, let's just look at this. There are almost 48,000 students in Madison today. 1,700 are black. So, you know, as, excuse me, and I know some graduates of UW-Madison that are black and who graduated within the last 15 years or so. And they basically tell me the same story. But to somehow think that, you know, UW-Madison is going to improve the numbers of African Americans on their campus is mind-boggling to me. Again, when you're talking about a 5% black population and you're talking about the highest percentile of that 5% who will be educated well enough to be able to go to UW-Madison, which is one of the top universities in the entire nation. That's what's at the root of it. And so, you know, the fact that it's not just UW-Madison. If you look at the major universities all over the nation and look at the black population that is there, still the same thing. You won't see large numbers, and that's because black people only make up 12% of the overall population of the entire nation. And most people don't know that. They don't have any clue that we are such a small percentage of this nation. And I think at the root of all of that is how there's mistreatment of the black population in this country, because we are such a minority population in this country. I was talking with a guy the other day who's an economist, and he said that on average, 40% of the black population in America, home, families, live on $17,000 a year. While the white population is 181,000.
Literally, how is that possible?
How is it possible? You mean that people can somehow live off of that?
Well, that, yes, but also, like, wow, how can we not address that gap?
Well, a lot of it has to do with racism and the fact that there are people who don't believe those statistics. And they think that all of that is based on the fact that black people don't want anything. They don't want to work. They don't want to do all these things. But very seldom, if ever, do you hear anything about redlining. Very seldom do you hear anything about the interest rates that blacks are charged and the fact that we are taken advantage of in a society. And somehow we are supposed to know that. Instead of addressing the disenfranchisement of African Americans in this nation, we talk about the fact that they're criminals and they don't want anything. But it has been frustrating to me all of my life. I remember the fight that Dr. King fought for us. And the fact that we continue that battle, even after all of these years, means that my father's generation never got to see justice. My generation will never see justice. My children's generation will never see justice. And then, you know, you got to face the realities of what happens in this country. And unfortunately, there are not many who will. But it's not a surprise to me that after all of these decades, UW-Madison still only has 2.2% of African Americans on their campus. 1969, 2.2%. 2002, 2.2% of those at UW-Madison. And again, you can go to any of the major universities, for the most part, across this nation, and you'll kind of see the exact same thing.
Even at Whitewater, you know, absolutely.
Whitewater, Oshkosh, Eau Claire, Platteville, Stevens Point. You know, it's and again, it's because we only make up 5% of the overall population. This is not, you know, the bastion of integration, not the state of Wisconsin. And it's been that way. So when I see the article like this in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, UW-Madison's black student enrollment has never exceeded 3%. Why does the school make so little progress decade after decade? Well, you know, again, the numbers, sheer numbers, are not there. And they're not ever going to be there. I don't think that's ever going to change. There's somehow not going to be an influx, a tremendous influx of black people in the state of Wisconsin. That's what it's going to be. That's what it's been. And you just have to live with that. But anyway, that's what's at the root of that. And I'm surprised that they had this article and are asking the question, you know, as if they don't know the statistics. It is a reality that our community is well aware of, and don't expect it to get any better as time goes on. Anyway, we got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. I see my friend has arrived, Sandy, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. And he's here. Sandy Williams has made it into the studio. Hey, Sandy, how you doing?
Yeah, I look like a river rat.
Yeah.
It's pretty wet and pretty slow going.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. And you remember... I remember constantly talking about the drought last year, and I kept saying to people, maybe the last year and a half, and I kept saying to people, one thing about Mother Nature, she never forgets. And during that drought, I kept saying, she's going to even things up.
Yeah.
Looks like she's evening things up.
Well, today she is, but yeah. I think the statistics for the year wouldn't suggest we've been super wet. I think we're probably right on average.
Yeah, and so we didn't get a lot of snow, so we didn't get a lot of runoff, So that didn't help much either. But it's really soaked. Yeah.
Yeah. Today's good.
Yeah, and it's been that way. It's been just a huge, huge storm. Over the Midwest over the last couple of days. So we finally got ours.
Although I live on the Milwaukee River and it's super low right now. So
it is.
It needs to be replenished.
Yeah.
And today I guess it's being replenished.
Yeah. So. Sandy.
Yeah.
So I went to look for some gas.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, seemed like only a few days ago, it was $4 and I could get gas for $4.60. A gallon. Now everywhere it's over $5.10 and 20 cents, and even in the city up to $5.39 and 49 cents.
I know you and I have this conversation. Commodities are remarkable in the way the prices can go up and down, and so now we're in an uptick because of these the shortage situations. And like I was explaining last week, trying to talk about a compartmentalized ocean, that the total production of oil in the world hasn't gone down, but it's become compartmentalized in a way that has caused it to become in short supply in some of those compartments. And it's going to even out in the long run as the marketplace, but as you, well, as somebody said, in the long run, everyone's dead.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the question is, how long is the short run? And you know, these things don't tend to take more than, it's going to be a long time when it comes out of my mouth, but 6 to 12 months.
Wow. Sandy, I mean, Sam, did you just hear him?
Well, I didn't say it was going to stay at this level for six to 12, but the whole supply chain situation associated with the fuel of oil will take a while because there are all these contracts under which they are currently allocated, and those contracts have to expire and new contracts have to come into place. And so that's going to take a while.
So we haven't seen the ceiling yet?
Probably not.
Ooh, that makes me.
Ow. Oh, we can see $6 a gallon gas in.
Well, you know, the Memorial Day is normally the high point in terms of driving, and so the high point of gas and oil. So it could be that this is the high point. It really just depends on the supply side at this point.
But Sandy, we got almost a 50-cent jump inside of a week.
Well, that was the week of Memorial Day.
Yeah, but man, 50-cent in a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, man, you know.
Put on your walking shoes.
Yeah, it is, man, it is, you know, when you stop and well, you got to ask the questions. The guys driving the big Lexuses. I mean, the big Escalades.
Well, the SUVs, the 7,000-pound cars.
Yeah, the Escalades. Yeah. They have to be, to fill that up from scratch, has to be $150.
Yeah, maybe. And when the cars are like measuring gallons per mile.
Yeah.
Those cars. Yeah.
You know, I remember going back to the oil embargo with Jimmy Carter and the prices of it back then. And we were able to at least, Sandy, downsize the vehicles. And they didn't make the big.
No! Back then, the cars were, you know, the GM automobiles were all gas guzzling automobiles, and back then a Volkswagen was deemed to be an economy car, but they only got about 22 miles to the gallon back then. So you know, the cars you and I drive now are all over 20 miles to the gallon.
But they certainly were able to change the trajectory of the vehicles that they were making. So
that was back when you could get a Monza. You could get one of those little, a Corvette.
Yeah, you know, they had.
No, not a Corvette. What was it?
Corvair.
Corvair.
A Corvair. Yes. You know, and that was when the Toyota was like a little Tonka truck.
No, a Chevette.
A Chevette, yeah.
Yes, that was.
Yeah, the Corvair was in the 60s.
Yeah, the Chevette was the. What do I call it? A piece of, yeah.
Yeah, a piece of that.
Yes.
But they also had, back then, the Maverick.
A piece of Chevette.
Yep.
That's what it was.
Yeah, they had the Maverick. They had, Ford had the Maverick. American Motors had the Sprint. And they had these real little cars.
Yeah, American Motors had the Pacer.
Pacer, yeah. And all of the, I had a Pacer.
Looked like an egg.
Yeah, and I had a Spirit or Sprint that they had too back then. But it really
and the Barracuda.
Well, the Barracuda was a power car.
A little bit
expensive.
Yeah.
Wait,
the Barracuda wasn't that? What was the
no?
One
the Barracuda that had was
6 foot of anything space. Was that the?
I don't, you know.
They had to take that ad off the TV because people began to imagine what that anything space was for.
You know, Sandy, we've been around a little while, right?
We're talking about. We should stop this.
Sounds like a lot of mumbo jumbo to me.
Well, you know, gasoline was 99 cents a gallon then, though. You know, mm-hmm. and those were the days, my friend, I guess.
Well, but a good annual income was $15,000 a year.
Yeah,
too,
so. Yeah. You know, Sandy, I had to talk about the gas, man. So Biden is asking for Saudi Arabia to increase production. All of those things still are slow. They're not going to change things.
Here's an unseemly picture. The President of the United States traveling all the way to Saudi Arabia to apparently get genuflect to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who has people dismembered.
Yeah. And after he had said and condemned and talked about Saudi Arabia in a manner, and I'm sure they're in a hurry. Yeah, we're willing to do that. Joe?
I'm just saying, when we measure our international affairs and the so-called morality that we use in measuring, for instance, whether Ukraine needs to be, its democracy needs to be defended, and yet we are traveling to Saudi Arabia, the president?
You know, Sandy, we're in for a long haul. I said it before, and I'll say it again. This is a long haul. It's not, none of these things are going to change overnight. So we just about got to go to a break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Sandy, I want to talk about the economy. I can't help but talk about the economy, man. Because it's starting to affect me.
Yeah.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. And I'm not the only person it's affecting. We'll be right back. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show.
Got to be with you, baby. It's being around you is all I see. Is what I want to do. We ought to stay together. Loving you
Wow. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. It's Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, it's always so good to have you in the studio, because what I didn't learn in school, you teach me as far as the economy and all those things, and many of us, but they're so complex, and so many of us don't understand how the economic system works in this country. We say we do, but we really don't, because it's so complex. It's another one of those times you say, well, it's complicated. this monetary system in this nation is complicated.
Well, yeah. I mean, we were talking off the air about this reversal of the quantitative easing,
right?
There has been writing now about.
So what is the quantitative easing?
Well, we talked about quantitative easing during the recession, and starting in 2008, the Federal Reserve started using its power to essentially print money and use that money to buy debt instruments, federal debt, as well as mortgage-backed securities and corporate debt. And they bought this debt and put it into essentially a portfolio owned by the government, and the portfolio had been financed on printed money. You know, it was new money that they used to generate the wherewithal to buy this stuff. And some of it was used to basically finance the debt, right? The government issues debt instruments to finance its deficit, and the government was buying it for itself. But everyone knew that at some point these debt instruments would be sold back to the public.
Well, Sandy, before you go any further,
yeah.
The more they print the money, what is that backed by?
Well, the federal government's money isn't backed by anything but the trust of the American people. Ever since Nixon broke the connection between the dollar and gold, there isn't something that backs the dollar other than the public's trust in the value of the dollar. And however, the dollar is an extremely valuable currency. I suppose in that respect, it's a bit like Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't have anything behind it other than a belief that someone's going to buy it from
you.
Yeah,
but the dollar is not Bitcoin. The world still looks at the dollar.
Well, but the dollar is a trusted currency in terms of its use for buying and selling things. And it's trusted to have a value. And that trust has created quite a stable value for the dollar. So what happened with quantitative easing is the government would put money into the economy, essentially. Increasing the dollars in the economy is an expansionist kind of thing. In all other things being equal, it's inflationary. But during the recession after 2008, our economy was in a potentially deflationary condition. So the government was, we had both big deficits that were essentially the Congress approving the expenditure of many more dollars by the government than they were taking in taxes. And on top of that, we had this quantitative easing with the Federal Reserve also injecting money into the economy to the tune of trillions of dollars. I think it was about $5 to $7 trillion total over the total period of this quantitative easing.
Yeah, it says $8 trillion.
$8 trillion. And so now that $8 trillion of assets is going to get sold back into the economy. And when the dollars were printed and used to purchase this, that was expansionary. And potentially inflationary, but it was in an economy that was in recession.
It was necessary.
Yeah. Now, when they sell those back into the economy, they'll be taking dollars out of the economy. People who buy those debt instruments will be essentially giving money back to the Federal Reserve, and so the amount of money in circulation will go down. That'll have a deflationary effect. It'll reduce inflation, and that's why it's being done.
Reducing inflation doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow process.
Well, inflation itself isn't necessarily such a slow process going up. It is true that deflation and the reduction of inflation can be relatively slow, but it certainly wasn't slow in 2008. I mean, when the window of the business cycle opens and closes, things tend to happen very abruptly. When the government uses its policies, things tend to happen more slowly. And so, this is probably going to have an effect to dampen inflation without ending inflation.
So you talk about the Federal Reserve, which is separate from the government,
it is a quasi-governmental entity, right?
It's
created by the government, but not run by the government correctly.
Yeah. So really can make policy.
Yes, and the whole the magic of it, from the standpoint of why it was created and why it has worked pretty well, is that because it's independent from politics per se, because it can make its policy independently, and because it can be trusted possibly until maybe the Trump administration, it could be trusted to operate independent from politics. The financial world and the public could believe that the Fed was going to operate responsibly to moderate inflation and to support employment. That's basically its mission, to try and get as close to full employment as possible without having the damage for the economy of inflation.
But how can it be separate from the government when the chair people are appointed by?
Well, they're supposed to be
by the government.
It's a bit like the Supreme Court, right? The Supreme Court isn't supposed to be responsive to Democratic and Republican voters, but its members are appointed. The Federal Reserve is similarly appointed, and happily, up to this point at least, the Federal Reserve has been perceived to be operating on more or less pure economic principles and not political principles.
So, and the Federal Reserve is not looking to make profit? They're not?
No. There's no profit motive on the part of the Federal Reserve board members and the head of the Federal Reserve, and happily also it has not appeared to be a revolving door for people to get a job at the Fed and then migrate over into a highly profitable financial community.
The Financial Times was a bearer of the predictable bad tidings yesterday. Just from that day's digital front pages, live news updates column, these were some of the headlines. Ford forecasts car industry consolidation as capital becomes constrained. Treasuries and U.S. stocks slip as investors gird for monetary policy tightening. Bank of Canada prepares to act more forcefully after latest rate raise. European stocks enter June on a muted note after turbulent month. German retail sales fell 5.4% in April. UK house price growth slows in May. China manufacturing sector activity shrinks for the third consecutive month, which is an automatic recession, right?
Right.
Government bonds sell off as Eurozone inflation hits record high. J.P. Morgan chief says hurricane is bearing down on economy. Sandy, that doesn't sound, you know, like a bright future.
Well, I think, you know, Jamie Dimon is actually, I find, a fairly principled guy in terms of his public utterances. He's the one who talked about the hurricane in the future.
Right.
And I do believe that there is a confluence of situations now which doesn't portend well for the financial performance
globally,
in the world globally, over the next 12 months. I think my hope is that you know, they talk about having a soft landing in an inflationary period. I hope we have a modest, a modest accident. You know, it's not going to be a soft landing per se, but I hope the damage that's done during the landing is modest.
You know, Sandy, you're clearly not saying that this is going to be a prolonged issue. And throughout my life, and me understanding somewhat about recessions and those kind of things and inflation that I've seen, I've never seen it turn around in a short period of time, especially global.
Well, yes, and I think the only hope here is that part of the driving force for this recession is going to be shortages.
Right.
And shortages of the right kind of labor in the right place, shortages in the supply chain, shortages of particular goods, and some of those shortages are created by short-term circumstances. So if we can reverse the shortages and those things can become plentiful, then the question is, how quickly can you revive the demand side for all those things that were in short supply? Because what's happening now is the recession might cure the shortages by shrinking the demand, right?
Yeah.
That's the bad, you know, the good news, bad news. Please, you know, end the shortage.
Right.
Okay, we're going to stop wanting what you make.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a very good way to solve it as far as you're concerned, if you're the supplier. But so, you know, there is some hope that a recession driven by shortages and temporary circumstances could be relatively short if you can solve for those things.
But Sandy, last week, you talked about an article that talked about 200 Americans making $250,000 a year, a living paycheck to paycheck.
Well, we've got a problem in our socioeconomic system in the United States that is different than the rest of the world, and the biggest part of our problem is that we, in our infinite wisdom, have decided politically not to have a social safety net for everybody in this country as regards health care and child care, education costs, okay, and adequate pensions. So in our country, in order to make it, we have to spend a considerable portion of that $250,000 or whatever we make, we have to spend a considerable portion of it on these fundamental things. And if we aren't spending it on it, then we're facing a future that is very
dire. So, Sandy, you
dire.
Keep beating that same drum. You're never going to get off that, are you?
I'm never going to get off it because I've had an epiphany and realized that we have backed our people into a corner, but it's not just our people. We've backed our economic system into a serious corner by deciding in the infinite wisdom of those conservatives who think that this kind of socialization, as they would characterize it, would be bad for the economy. And my epiphany is that no, what's bad for the economy is not having it.
Yeah. Okay. We've got to go to a break. Phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
I could last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been
welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 2789. You can text us at that same number. You're tuning into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Monday with Sandy Williams, and it's always great to bounce things off Sandy, and he comes back with answers that, you know, you don't hear in many other places. Who do we have on the line, Sam?
Up first, we have David from Mequon.
Hey, Dave, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing this morning? Wonderful. Really quickly, so obviously I have a much different view than Sandy does as far as government intervention. And the reason being, I've looked, when I went to school back at University of Minnesota, and when I went into urban planning, I did a whole analysis on low-income housing and other things. And what came to me, what was an epiphany for me, was the fact that a lot of these low-income projects benefited for a few large developers. And at the end of the day, the people that are moving in there, they're not able to create generational wealth. And that's the case. And it erodes the tax base to that particular city because they're not a homeowner. We're literally paying people to move into low-income housing, and we're helping big banks, and we're helping big developers to take the tax credits and literally just saying, oh, here you go. And what's happening is, at the end of the day, we're actually doing a disservice for those individuals rather than have them encouraged to buy a house or some piece of property that they can pass on to the next generation. We're not doing that. So that literally has been an erosion of many people and being able to pass along whatever they have onto the next generation and go from there.
Well, David, it's interesting. It's anecdotal. But in today's world, how much money do you think a family would have to make to not live paycheck to paycheck and to have enough money? Let's say there's a family with three children, and the children are under 10, and some of them require daycare, and the family is not employed. Both parents work, but neither parent works for someone who is buying them health benefits because that's the more common kind of job these days. How much do you think that family would have to make in order not to live paycheck to paycheck and to have enough money to set aside that amount of money per month that would allow them to develop the savings they would need to have a down payment to have that generational wealth potential of buying a house? So let's just start with the family. You got to live more than paycheck to paycheck to save money. How much money do you think it takes in today's world to do that?
Well, again, there, Sandy, it depends on where you live.
Let's just take Milwaukee.
Well, how about Manitowoc?
Let's take a population center. Let's take where most of the people live, which are in population centers, okay? And so let's go to a population center. And how much do you think a family in a population center has to make so that they aren't living paycheck to paycheck? And incidentally, the median income in the United States right now for such a family is $75,000. Do you think $75,000 is enough to live better than paycheck to paycheck?
It'd be tough. No, especially
we can do the math right now. It only takes about a minute. And and the fact is that they can't, because how much do you think health care will cost that family a year?
And that $75,000 is the median.
So half the family.
Half the family.
I want to unbundle this because maybe you and I can reach agreement after we look at the facts about how this all works.
Okay.
So how health care is going to cost essentially a minimum of $15,000 a year. How much do you think daycare?
But that's not true either, because now we're giving subsidies, massive subsidies.
No, not for a family. Not for a family with $75,000. So let's say we've got $75,000, and it's going to cost $15,000 for health care. How much do you think it's going to cost them for child daycare? Have you been involved in that at all?
It'll for cost each 15. Child, from my understanding, it'll be about $10,000.
Well,
for each child.
Well, they can probably bundle them up. I'm willing to go with $15,000. So let's go.
Okay.
Now we've spent $30,000 of the $75,000. How much do you think that family of $75,000 pays in taxes?
Well, they will get tax credits having the kids.
Sure they will, can we say $7,000?
That would actually be lower, based on the fact that the way
I think if you measure state and federal taxes, I think you'll find that they would pay at least 10% of their gross income as taxes. But I'm willing to go with less. Okay, so that's $7,500. Okay. So now we've got $7,500. Now we've spent $37,500 of the seventy-five. Okay, now how much do you think they'll pay for rent to have a 3-bedroom place?
Well, again, don't you think,
will you take $3,000 a month as a probable cost in a municipal center for a 3-bedroom?
No. Yeah. Not $3,000 a month. No.
Do you think
it's higher or lower? Because I pay quite a bit for 1-bedroom a month.
One bedroom.
Well, that's in Madison is out of.
I'm in Waukesha, and that's actually the second cheapest city in Wisconsin for rent. So,
let's just say $3,000 a month, just for the purpose. You know, we can argue about whether it's $2,500.
I can't afford Madison. Thank you.
So $3,000 a month is $36,000 a year, and the money's gone. Mm-hmm. All $75,000 are gone, and we haven't bought food. We haven't paid for utilities. We haven't gotten transportation,
clothing.
So we can even whittle any of those down, and you still don't have enough left to do anything but paycheck to paycheck. You're not saving money to buy a house there. A family of $75,000 is not going to save money to buy a house. Not unless they've inherited money. Not unless they've gotten a bundle of money someplace.
This is the whole problem. Again, the whole reason why.
Wait, Dave. Let's unbundle it, because if those people lived in a country like every other developed country that paid for child daycare and paid for health care, they'd have.
Who's going to pay for that child daycare?
Well, there's taxes to be paid. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
there's,
but if you literally
no, but no, wait, 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 have, wait a minute, wait a minute.
Okay.
So if you take the increase in taxes. If there was Medicare for all, then there would be an increase in taxes, but the increase in taxes paid by anybody would probably be less than the reduction they would have in the healthcare premium that they would otherwise be paying. And if it isn't less, it'll be less certainly for people at lower income levels if we have a progressive tax rate. So there's no question to me that a family of $75,000 is paying $15,000 for healthcare premiums would not get a $15,000 tax increase if we had Medicare for all.
Wait, so you're telling me that there is absolutely no subsidy for a person at $75,000 with a couple of kids?
No, I didn't say that. Subsidy? No, there's no. We just went through the process. There can be subsidies that can offset some of their taxes, but we agreed that they would pay.
Still not going to position them.
We agreed that they would pay a net tax. I just think that the world at large, politicians at large, and everyone else. Because, you know, the most recent story, I think, in both the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere was that most families earning $250,000 a year were living paycheck to paycheck.
And that's due to the fact that if you look at what's going on in the state of California or the state of New York and New York City, or if you look at Chicago, they're not affordable because the local tax rates are so out of whack. As far as even Milwaukee County, one of the reasons why I left Milwaukee County
let me just finish my point. Because we got to take a break. We've had you on. Thank you very much. All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be back.
We only got one more. That's all we got. One more.